Welcome to today's webinar compiled and produced by the team at biznews.com. All of our webinars are interactive. We encourage you to pose questions to our guests. The more challenging, the better. And the earlier you get the questions in, the better the chance of having them answered. The recording of this webinar will be available later today on the biznews.com channel on YouTube.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to today's BizNews Finance Friday webinar. Our guests today are Jonathan Buerter from Netto Invest in Cape Town and Dawn Ridler from Keringa Wealth Ecology in Johannesburg. So two independent advisors here to answer your questions. So welcome, Dawn, and welcome, Jonathan.
Thanks, Jackie.
Hi, everyone.
And welcome to everybody who's joined the webinar. Please do start getting your questions into the chat box that you can see next to you. Stu, I wonder if you just want to flag up and just check to make sure everybody can pop their questions in the box there.
Thanks, Jax. Welcome, John and Dawn. Just quickly, if you can hear Jax or hear my voice, so I'm talking now, and see Jackie, Jonathan, and Dawn on screen with the presentation, the little high-five button on the control panel. If you can just click that, then at least we know we're coming through loud and clear. There we go, Jax. I've got one or two coming through. That's good news. Always good to see. And as Jax mentioned, there's little questions drop down on the panel on the right-hand side of your screen. If you plop them in there, Jax, and pass them on. But as I said, in early, us time seems to run very quickly in these webinars. Thanks, Jax.
Thank you. So before we get going with the questions, I first want to tell you a bit more about our panelists. So Jonathan Buerter has a BCom, and as I mentioned, he's with Netto Invest in Cape Town, and he says he has a holistic approach to financial planning. Jonathan, perhaps you could briefly sketch out, what does holistic mean in this context? We often hear that financial advisors have this holistic approach. What does that entail?
Yeah, so thanks, Jackie. So hi to all the listeners out there. And yeah, what holistic financial planning involves, it means just looking at your overall sort of financial planning picture, and not just looking at one piece of the sort of financial planning puzzle in isolation. So it's just that broad overall view of financial planning, looking at everything from investments to estate planning to insurance if you need it. So it's just that overall view of financial planning.
Thank you. And then Dawn, you also have this approach to financial planning, and you bring in this emphasis on ecology. Perhaps you could just, for our attendees who aren't familiar with your process, just sketch out how your approach differs from other financial advisors and wealth managers.
You know, like Jonathan, I'd also take a holistic approach, and my background is in botany and ecology and zoology, and I just found that by using sort of what I learned as a botanist and as an ecologist and bringing it to the financial field, where you're talking about a system where they're all interrelated, that it's easier for a client to actually understand the concepts when it's made, you know, when I use analogies with things that they're perhaps more familiar with from, you know, being in a bush or, you know, being in a garden or things like that.
And we heard earlier you've got a very interesting had a very interesting start to your career teaching medical students, and you've also lived in Madagascar and all sorts of places. So you know a lot about botany. How did you move to the financial side of things?
To put it very bluntly, I knew I was never going to make enough money as a botanist. Sort of 1 year into my doctorate, I decided to do an MBA. So that's the long and short of it. It was purely fiscal.
Okay, thank you. And Jonathan, why did you decide to become a financial advisor?
Yeah, this is the same sort of story. Yeah, no, I enjoyed working with people. So I started out doing auditing, and I found that I preferred to sit with people and try and help them achieve their sort of financial goals and objectives. as opposed to, you know, doing auditing in the background, ticking boxes. So I just found it was a personality thing for me. I just found I rather preferred to work with people as opposed to crunching numbers in the background.
Okay. And today we're going to be talking about Bitcoin and also the fund performance in South Africa. And so, Jonathan, you sent in a few slides. Perhaps we can just talk through those briefly before we move on to some of the points that Dawn wanted to make, and then we'll take the questions. So, yeah, Jonathan, perhaps if you just want to talk through these details, and I'll just move the slides for you.
Great. Thanks very much. Yeah, so I think it's always important when we're talking about assessing sort of what the performance has been with regards to the local asset managers, you know, it's important when we're having a discussion about local asset managers, it's important to just bear in mind that, you know, a lot of the portfolios that we construct have a lot of offshore within the portfolio. So today we're going to sort of chat about the local asset managers, but just with the caveat that, you know, we still like the offshore exposure and we still think it's a good thing to have within the portfolios. But today we're going to have sort of a focus on the local asset managers and what they've done. So what I've just done is I've just thought we could start with just looking at, you know, what sort of what has the returns been from the JSE over the last few periods. So what I wanted to just highlight on this slide was just, you know, what the JSE has done over the last period. So if we look at it over the last year, the JSE, the all shares returned about 7% over 1 year. Sort of 5 year returns, we're seeing about 6.5%. So the returns on the local environment have been a bit sort of flat. They've been a bit narrow. And yeah, it's been a difficult place for the asset managers to operate in this local environment. And that on the fifth line over there, we've got this sort of MSCI World Index, which just shows you what the sort of international funds have done, the World Index has done over that same period. So you can see compared to the local all share of 7%, the sort of MSCI has done about 20% over that same time period. So a very difficult place for the asset managers to operate in this local environment.
I see the exception is resources.
Yeah, exactly. So there's been a couple of places. So when we talk about the returns on the local environment, it's been a very narrow sort of a place to be. And what I mean by that is there's been some places where, so for example, if you've had exposure to Naspers as well as the resources sector, so gold and platinum stocks, you've done very well. So the asset managers that have had those exposures would have done really well. If you've been exposed to the banking sector or the South African consumers in the sense of the retailers, they've had a very difficult time over the last 5 years or so. The financials sector over the last 5 years has given 0% return over the last 5 years, which has been a horrible place to be. And if we look at that the sort of the top performers, that next slide, what I was just highlighting here is exactly that. You know, the top performers over the last 1 year and 5 years, you can definitely see there's a theme there. There's the mining stocks have done phenomenally well. So there's a different theme where you'd want to be over the last couple of years.
Thank you. And then the worst performers.
Yeah, so again, that just talks to, you know, being such a narrow sort of, it's a tightrope that the asset managers are having to walk. And if you caught up, you know, if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, that's going to make a huge difference to what your portfolio returns have been. So, you know, over the last 5 years, the worst sort of performers have been the tourism sector. You can see there the hotels, the gaming, and the property sector. So those have had a horrible time over the last 1 and sort of 5 years. There's also been the sort of the black swan events in terms of Sasol and Steinhoff's. So, you know, if the asset managers have had exposure to those two stocks, they would have struggled with their local performance over those periods.
And then the local asset managers, how have they done?
Yeah, so what I've done here is I've just tried to show, so I've kept it anonymous. I haven't labeled the asset managers purely because I can give you that info. I've got it if your listeners want it. We just thought we like the people at BizNews and we don't want you to get hate mail after this. So I've just kept it anonymous. But yeah, so what we're looking at there is the asset managers, just four top asset managers in the country. What have they done over the last 1, 3, and 5 years? And you'll see that, you know, the last year has been okay for some of the managers, returning, you know, close to 10%. One of the managers has obviously lagged, one of the big managers in South Africa. And over the last 5 years, the numbers have been very flat. So the point of this slide, what I'm trying to illustrate here is just is to say, you know, when we're looking at returns, it's very difficult to know, you know, what the performance has looked like. So often I use the analogy, being South Africans, we like sport, to say, you know, the Springboks, for example, scored 3 tries. You know, what does that actually mean? You need to benchmark that against something. So, you know, 3 tries, is that good or bad? If you're playing against England and it's the Rugby World Cup final and they only scored 1 try, then that's great. 3 tries is phenomenal. So when we're looking at the returns there over a 1, 3, and 5 year period, what does 7.5% mean over 5 years? Is that good or is that bad? And what we need to do is we need to benchmark that against certain benchmarks in the industry. And there's a number of them. I've just chosen a couple of them just to have a look at. And some of the benchmarks could be inflation, it could be cash, it could be benchmarking against what the all share index has done over those periods. Or you could benchmark your asset manager against a peer of other asset managers, which is that last benchmark there, the multi-asset sort of high equity benchmark. And if we look at those benchmarks, what we can see then is over a 1 year period, the average manager in South Africa, a high equity manager in South Africa, has done 5.7% over the last year. And the other managers, those top 4 managers at the top, they've all managed to, well, except for the one, have beaten the average of the asset managers over that same time period, and the same thing for 5 years. So it's just important when looking at returns to just benchmark it against something so that you can assess whether it's good or average performance.
And just for people who aren't familiar with benchmarking, how do you assess this? This is quite a disappointing return, isn't it, when you consider these are the top asset managers in South Africa? This is the best they could do. They are paid to generate superior returns from assets, and that's all that they manage. So it does sort of lend the argument that maybe we should go for passive investing.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Jackie, because one of those top 4 managers that I've got in there is a passive investment strategy, and it'll be impossible for you to actually, well, I mean, you could take a guess, but you wouldn't be able to pick from just looking at those which one of those is the passive investment versus the active. The one of those managers is a passive investment, and you can't pick it. But as you mentioned, that's important to look at that benchmarking against the long term, and to see, you know, what those asset managers have done over the last 5 years compared to inflation, for example. You know, they're barely keeping ahead of inflation. The elephant in the room is cash, obviously struggling against cash. So benchmarking is very important to assess performance.
So have you given up on local asset managers then, Jonathan, at your firm?
No, so that's a difficult question, because what we, you know, so it's local asset managers have a place in a portfolio, in the sense of, you know, we end up having local asset managers in our sort of retirement portfolios, and that's due to the nature of the retirement annuity environment in South Africa. So, you know, to be able to add to your retirement investments through work, you might end up having to have a provident fund or a pension fund through work. And through that, you'll be forced to end up investing in local sort of asset managers due to the regulatory nature of, you know, retirement saving in South Africa. So we end up having clients building up retirement local portfolios in South Africa, which ends up meaning that we end up with these asset managers in South Africa. So, you know, if we had a choice, we would say we might lean towards the offshore asset managers over the local managers. But in reality, we find that our clients end up building up retirement investments in South Africa, which means they have exposure to the local asset managers. And there's pros and cons to both of those sort of scenarios. You know, using retirement annuities and investments, you're getting a tax deduction on the money that's going into those investments, which is something that we can't overlook in terms of a part of the overall financial planning picture.
Before we move on to Dawn, does that tax benefit actually help when the returns are so poor? Isn't it better to just look elsewhere for opportunities to build wealth?
Yeah, so I think it also depends on what sort of income bracket you're in. So, for example, if you're a high income earner at the 45% tax bracket, to walk away from a 45% tax deduction on your contributions into retirement annuity, I think, you know, it makes sense to make use of those. But perhaps if you're at the lower end of the income bracket and, you know, getting an 18% deduction on contributions into retirement annuity, that might not be as attractive as the high income earners. So yeah, it does depend. It is case specific to each individual client.
Thank you, Jonathan. Dawn, what is your view on the local asset management environment? Do you find any sort of outliers, or do you look at a similar chart and think that this is really quite a disappointing set of affairs?
Obviously, mostly what we do is we diversify asset classes, because a lot of what we're talking about here is what's happening on the stock exchange. And, you know, the sort of poor performance from a stock exchange is not new. You know, it's been around, as Jonathan knows, coming close to 7 years now of this really lackluster performance, which starts to, it's no longer short term, it's hardly even medium term, it's now a long term problem. And the only way to really get around it is diversification. One of the things that we do when it comes to picking assets in that stock area is we try and balance the fee with the performance, and, you know, so at least get and you can find, you know, very well performing unit trusts in that sort of equity space or in that balance space, and not necessarily have to pay the, you know, 2%, 1.9% that you're paying with some of the more popular, read advertised, read big buildings in Sandton kind of asset managers. You can get that kind of thing. You can, if you look and you know where to look, you can actually get really decent unit trusts at passive fees, right? Passive investing in this country isn't as cheap as we get it overseas. You know, overseas, you know, you might pay 1 or 2 or 3 percentage or basis points. In this country, you're paying closer to 30, 40. There's some exit fees and this kind of thing. But there are, you know, it's a matter of actually finding those sort of less popular, less advertised, but good performing low cost fees and blending them in, you know, in with other assets. We've been using a lot of fixed assets with just bonds and cash in our clients' portfolios for a while now.
Thank you, Dawn. Before we move,
you know, maximizing the offshore.
Before we move on to having a quick chat about blockchain and Bitcoin, there's been a lot in the news about Alan Gray. It used to be the absolute darling of the asset management environment, and it seems that their performance fees are getting the better of them. Jonathan, do you look at that closely at all when you decide where to place your clients' funds? How do performance fees factor in for you?
Yeah, we need to look at performance fees very closely, and as Dawn mentioned, fees are a very important part of constructing portfolios, and we look at that very closely. And yeah, Alan Gray have had a very tough time in terms of their local performance or performance in general. You know, as mentioned, the band is so narrow at the moment. So if you've got exposure, if you've had exposure to the Sasols and the Steinhoffs and the likes, and you've missed the mining resources and the Nuspasses, then you're going to have a very difficult time in terms of trying to generate value for your clients. And we do find that the fees are coming under severe pressure, and it's something that we look at very closely. We also take into account that we look at the difference between sort of retail prices versus the sort of institutional prices. And what I mean by that is, you know, portfolio managers constructing a fund of fund versus going directly to an asset manager and using their sort of retail fund, you can end up unlocking a bit of value there in terms of a cost saving for your clients if you make use of the sort of multi-manager fund-to-fund approaches.
Don't they charge more though? Isn't that just another layer of fees? having a multi-manager in the middle?
So not necessarily. What it allows the sort of portfolio managers and the fund of funds to do, again, you're correct, you need to look at that closely and make sure that you're making use of the correct sort of strategies. But what we end up finding is that, you know, a portfolio manager, that the well-costed portfolio manager can end up going to these retail companies like the Allan Grays and the Coronations and the 91s, et cetera, and can go to them with a group of assets and get those retail funds at a discount and be able to construct a portfolio at a slightly lower cost than going to those asset managers directly.
Thank you. Dawn, before we move on, just briefly, I know you've spoken about performance fund fees before, and there seems to be a lot of devil in the detail. Superficially, it sounds like a good idea, a performance fee. If the fund does well, then the fund manager gets a bonus. And if the fund doesn't do well, then somehow they don't benefit. But aren't these performance fees constructed in ways that are designed to benefit the asset manager, regardless of how the performance turns out?
You know, I think one of the things when you're looking at these popular funds that have performance fees is to look and see what benchmark they're using. And that is where they can quite frankly screw you over. You know, if you don't read that small print and see at what point are they taking performance fees. If they're taking performance fees from Rand One of any return, and some of them do, you know that's seriously not a good idea. I'm just not a fan of performance fees, because it is people that are buying the fund in the future that are getting paying those fees, not the people that actually had advantage of it. So for a whole bunch of reasons, when it comes to fund of funds, when you get a fund manager who puts together fund of funds to bring down the costs, awesome. But then they then go often. I'm not saying everybody, Jonathan, by any matter of means, but you do get fund managers who then use that opportunity of getting the discount so that they can add their own little bit to it, right? Instead of passing those savings on.
I think that's really where you do need an advisor to help you, guide you on those fees, because they can be quite complex. Thank you for that. Before we take the questions, Dawn, we've had a lot of questions in about how do you invest in blockchain and Bitcoin. And you mentioned that you get this question a lot from your clients. And in fact, you have a portion of funds invested in that area. Perhaps you could briefly explain what's happening in that space and why you've gone for a bit of a diversification with that.
We took the view, me and the asset managers, that blockchain is becoming a lot more ubiquitous. You know, it is almost becoming pedestrian. It's getting sort of traction as almost like a fiat currency. Look, it's a long way away from that. Make no mistake, right? But we just felt that with the depreciation in the dollar and probably continued depreciation in the dollar, you know, when you're printing that much money to stimulate the American economy, you're likely to see a continued depreciation in the dollar. And that is one of the reasons that Bitcoin, you know, had a nice little uplift in the last couple of months. Look, it's come down again and that kind of thing. But our diversification in there is really hedging against dollar depreciation more than anything else. And, you know, obviously we put commodities in there also as another hedge against dollar depreciation, because they're often linked. But the diversification is really small. You know, we're talking sort of 2% kind of thing. And the asset managers who are buying and selling, you know, in these offshore portfolios have a level at which they buy and a level at which they sell. You know, they have a sweet spot and they're pretty disciplined at sticking to that. So, you know, if I've got clients that come to me here and say, oh, yeah, I want to put, you know, I want, you know, since, you know, my friend, mate, you know, is going to put a whole lot of money into Bitcoin, what shall I do? And I just say to them, if this is excess money, if this is money that, you know, you would have spent on, you know, like we talked about, maybe going on a cruise and I can't go on a cruise, or this is just, you know, entertainment money that you maybe would otherwise have gone to Monte Casino or something like that, then by all means, you know, I don't control that kind of consumption. If you want to have a flutter, because basically that's what it is, you know, who am I to say that, you know, but just make sure that it's excess money. It's money that you can afford to lose. And it also, with any stocks, or especially speculative stocks like that, it's a good idea for somebody to have a bit of discipline, to say, right, I'm buying it at 30,000 or bought it at 9,000. I mean, most of the Bitcoin that is in our clients' offshore portfolios were bought at a sort of 9,000-10,000 level. So obviously the concentration's gone up a bit. Is to say, okay, I bought it at 30,000. If it goes below X thousand, I'm going to sell out. If it goes above 40,000, I'm going to sell out, right? It's managing your personal fear and greed. And that can be a huge learning curve, and not a lot of people get that right. You know, it's very, very difficult when you've had a good run on something to sort of like now bail out.
And so that's, but, you know, it's, so that's the Bitcoin. What about the blockchain companies? Do you invest in those at all?
You know, blockchain, in my opinion, is going to be a game changer across so many different industries. Every day you read about new ways which this blockchain technology can be used over and above cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin cryptocurrency, and there are a whole bunch of these cryptocurrencies. When it comes to blockchain, which is a way of actually embedding the custodianship, the origins of money and this kind of thing, that once that is used and used properly, you know, money laundering and all this kind of thing will become a thing of the past, right? I know that there are artists that are starting to embed blockchain in digital pictures and things like that, to protect copyright. Because, you know, once that block has been put in place, you can't change it. So you can sort of lock the custody and the sort of chain of custody or something. It's a brilliant, brilliant new invention. And they're only, I think, only scratching the surface. Whether big, you know, I understand the appeal of Bitcoin. You know, Bitcoin was put in, was to democratized currency, you know, it's the banks, you know, and the fees and the forex fees are when you move money from one place to the next, that the cryptocurrency gets around that quickly, efficiently, and without fees, right? So I mean, I really understand that sort of democratization. I mean, it's not way different from the democratization that you're seeing with Robinhood and the, you know, shenanigans that are going on there at the moment. But you know, I think it will settle down, you know, but the problem is trust, is getting people to trust in it. You know, and I think that is the biggest problem. I mean, but there again, you know, what currencies do you trust in, especially when you've got, you know, maybe a government or something printing money at a hell of a rate? I mean, I've got a billion rand Zim dollar note.
What can you do with that? Nothing.
Not a lot. I think worth a couple of cents, I think. Yeah, but it's just cool, right? But I mean, you know, so it's all very well to say, you know, oh, but, you know, normal currencies and dollars, they're, you know, backed by governments and this kind of thing. And look, the American government is printing money at a rate that we just don't understand at this point in time, you know. So, you know, it's just lucky that they're so big, that the dollar is so ubiquitous and everything else. But boy, are they printing money.
Thank you, Dawn. Jonathan, do you buy Bitcoin?
No, we don't. So again, as Dawn mentioned, we separate the two between Bitcoin and the blockchain technology, and yeah, I mean, I think Bitcoin has got such a long way to go to be an accepted currency, and if it ever will, you know, I have my doubts that it ever will, because there's just so many sort of headwinds in terms of acceptance, in terms of legislation, and actually just being able to process transactions at an appropriate level to make it a day-to-day sort of a currency, besides the volatility of the pricing. So I think it's got its headwinds, but in terms of a asset class, you know, Bitcoin seems to have sort of correlated itself with the likes of gold and silver, and that's on the back of the US dollar depreciation and the US just printing money, which means that there are some inflationary pressures potentially on the cards, which has helped those sort of hedges against inflation, which gold was always typically the hedge against inflation, the sort of go-to currency or asset class. Now Bitcoin is part of that sort of peer group. So I think, yeah, Bitcoin is just too volatile with too many headwinds for us to sort of make use of. But the blockchain technology is very exciting. So in terms of blockchain technology, that's within the portfolios. And a lot of clients will probably not even realize that they've got exposure to blockchain technology within their portfolios. The likes of Amazon, IBM, you know, they're all developing MasterCard, they're all developing their blockchain technology within their companies. So yeah, through those big sort of offshore stocks, you've got exposure to blockchain technology, which is quite exciting. So yeah, we don't directly make use of it in our portfolios, and it's always quite funny when I have meetings with clients, I always know that they always start the meeting with "Don't laugh, but," and then I know it's coming that they've bought some Bitcoin. And often the theory of it and in practice always works quite different. So in theory, it could work. I mean, it has worked. The price has gone from a couple of cents to, you know, 600,000 Rand. I think it hit just under 700,000 Rand at the peak. So that's phenomenal returns. But in practice, what we find is our clients end up getting caught up in the hype. And then they end up buying at the peaks of these sort of, you know, when the media and the hype is building, they end up getting in at the top, and then the pullback inevitably comes, and then they end up sitting with these Bitcoin that at a loss, and they need to sort of hold it out and wait until the returns come back.
So they've come back a few times, haven't they? The Bitcoin's bounced back a few times. So yeah. Well, thank you very much. Our first question is actually from Billy, and it's not strictly a personal finance question, but he says, please can the panel tell us what energy resources blockchain uses? I believe that it requires a lot of energy and space, more so than conventional practice. Are there developers out there who are working on reducing the carbon footprint of blockchain? Dawn, would you like to take that question?
You know, answering the second part first, it's quite interesting that, yeah, can you hear me? Can you hear me, Jackie?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. We lost you briefly, but I can hear you.
Interestingly, there are Bitcoin miners in the States that run off a solar grid. And when there's high demand for electricity, they switch the Bitcoin mining off. And then, you know, use the energy when there isn't such a demand for, you know, for the energy on the grid, which I you know, is quite interesting. But traditionally, obviously, it requires dirty, great big machines and a hell of a lot of electricity. And as a result, you find a lot of the miners in China, for example, energy and that kind of thing subsidized, right? And I mean, it's very dirty energy. It is a huge concern. But you know, the thing to understand now is that, you know, for every Bitcoin that is produced, is requiring more and more and more energy, which is why there's the concern. But there, you know, there's only 20 million Bitcoin out there, and we're already sitting at 18.5 million, right? So, you know, theoretically it's capped, but Bitcoin is just code, you know. But the thing is that there's so much vested interest. I mean, it's only something in $400 billion. I think it is about 0.5% of world GDP, which is about where we are, actually, that is available in Bitcoin. So it is capped. It is supposed to be a finite resource. So, you know, it isn't quite as, you know, so I think even the sort of the Bitcoin miners, that's why you find them falling off the map. They just, you know, the amount that they have to pay for electricity just doesn't pay them anymore to produce Bitcoin. So you're going to find alternative people who can do it alternatively to find the last 2 million.
Jonathan, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think, not much. I mean, Dawn hit the nail on the head. It's very sort of if you're not using solar, it's a very dirty sort of a resource to mine in terms of energy usage. So if you can find a sustainable green way of doing it, that would be great. But I believe it's very power heavy. So solar would work. But it's not very green at the moment.
Thank you. Hope that answers your question, Billy. Shaman wants to know, with an offshore portfolio, for example, if you have shares with WebTrader, is it wise to have a separate will in addition to your local one? You both specialize in holistic planning, so I'm sure this is something that you have to do all the time. Dawn, would you like to answer that first?
It's going to depend on the jurisdiction of the trading platform and the rules that apply there. So if you don't have a will, for example, say your trading platform is in Luxembourg or maybe it's Isle of Man, doesn't matter where it is, right? Each of those will have requirements. If you don't have a will there, all that happens is it becomes intestate. And that is not a train smash unless it's, the whole life savings that your family is going to live on should you die prematurely, right? So what would happen is the executor would wind up the estate here, would close the will. It would then get sent to, say, Isle of Man, Guernsey, Jersey, wherever it is, that do require separate wills, right, that need to be lodged and they need to have a probate officer. So it would go there, a probate officer would get appointed, they would wind it up, close it and send it back here. So it just means a delay, you know, because if a will does exist, say in Guernsey, who I know requires a separate will, then the two estates can be wound up at the same time.
So the more offshore assets you have, the more complex it can get. Jonathan, how do you manage all of this with your clients and their wills? Do you have to have different advisors in different jurisdictions, or is there one person that can sort of have full oversight of everything?
Yeah, you can have an advisor. You can have separate advisors in different jurisdictions if you like, but it's not necessary. It can be managed by one advisor that's got the knowledge to do that. So yeah, I think it's very important if you've got a large asset base with assets all over the world. It's important that you have that you look at your estate planning very carefully to make sure that you don't miss something in terms of having the right will in the right jurisdiction. Because as Dawn mentioned, it can just add some serious delays in terms of trying to wind up the estate if you don't have all of those things in place. And it's also important to just look at sort of probate and situs taxes that are applicable to those different jurisdictions. So it's important that your financial planner has knowledge of those international jurisdictions when putting financial plans together for you.
Thank you. And Peter wants to know, currently I have a living annuity at Allan Gray. What advantage is there to moving, and will it cost me money to move?
It's how long is a piece of string? One, it won't cost him money to move, probably. Okay. It's Allan Gray. Likely it won't. It's a Section 36 transfer. It wouldn't cost him money to move. The only advantages would be in terms of the funds that are and the structure of the portfolio. That, perhaps you have perhaps lower fees, better performing, more aligned to the income that you're going to be pulling out of a living annuity. I think that's one very important consideration is what income is required and how is it being produced. I think it boils down to having a decent planner. If you've got a decent planner, it actually doesn't matter where the living annuity is. And if the because even on Allan Gray, you can probably find funds that are better suited to the living annuity if he's not happy with them. It just really, at the end of the day, you want somebody who will work with you and talk through the reservations that you have and see if those reservations can be fixed, because a really good planner, won't break something if they can fix it. So if it can be fixed on the Allan Gray platform, a good planner would fix it on the Allan Gray platform. And not just move it just for no reason. It's the tide brokers. Sorry, any of you out there, tide brokers, but that say, I can help you, but it has to be liberty or liberty, maybe Stanlib as well. That's essentially the issue when it comes to tide. You need an independent financial advisor to give you advice. Can this be fixed? Because an independent financial advisor can probably look after it for you on the Allan Gray platform, and you don't have to move it.
Thanks, Jonathan. You're nodding there. Do you have anything to add to that?
No, I completely agree. The Section 30 transfer from Allan Gray to any of the other platforms won't cost you anything. It's completely, you can do that. But as Dawn mentioned, there's probably whatever the underlying causes that's making you want to move, there's probably something else that might be there that could be fixed on that Allan Gray platform that could solve your issue. But yeah, moving it from one platform to another doesn't cost you, unless it's linked to one of those sort of older style sort of products where it's the standards or the liberties or whatever it might be, then it might cost you a penalty to move it. The other thing to also just be mindful of at the moment, so some of the platforms are hitting their sort of offshore capacity constraints. So I don't know if that's something that the listener might be referring to. On the Allan Gray platform at the moment, so this would be a new living annuity, it's not necessarily one that's already on the platform, you can only have 60% offshore capacity within your living annuity. So there are other platforms that still have their full 100% capacity available. So for example, yeah, you know, you could move then to another platform that's got that sort of 100% capacity if that's something that you're looking for. So, but as I said, it's probably an underlying something that's concerning your listener, as opposed to the moving it. The moving it can be done quite easily and cost-free.
And before we move to the next question, just on the subject of that offshore capacity, do you think that's going to change in the budget in February? Do you think that will be eased? So meaning that you won't have to change to another platform if you want to take advantage of a broader opportunity to invest offshore through the living annuity.
Yeah, I'm not actually sure what if that's going to happen in this budget. I have my doubts. I think these offshore capacity, when these asset managers hit their capacity, that's something that you know, it's going to take a bit of time for them to fix that in terms of, you know, changing their sort of capacity, the constraints that they've got. So I don't think it's going to be done within the budget environment, but it could be. I'm not sure. That could be something that we could look out for. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Ian has a very broad question. How do you think COVID will affect offshore investments in the next few years? So quite a big question. Dawn, how are you factoring COVID into your longer term planning for your offshore investments?
I think there's going to be more constraints here than I mean, you know, Africa has, you know, no vaccines. No, one, Mr. Anton Rupert, right? But on, you know, whereas, you know, is Israel is, you know, well on its way to getting everybody vaccinated, you know, all around the world, they're, you know, well on the track to sort of getting this herd immunity. Because really, it's only when you can get free travel and this kind of thing. And I mean, at the moment, tourism is dead. And tourism is probably going to be dead the whole of this year, right? In this country and all the related industries. And, you know, that's before we even talk about being shooting ourselves in the foot with alcohol prohibitions and stupid things like that. But, you know, I think once vaccinations take hold, you know, things are going to start getting really, really back to normal. And once there's broad acceptance, it becomes a bit of a snowball effect. You still got people who are reluctant to take the vaccine, but as they see more and more people taking it, it'll be a snowball effect, and they'll probably during the course of the year get up to sort of 80% kind of thing and have herd immunity. Africa's going to be a long way away from that, and it's going to be much more difficult for us to get our economy going, you know, without having that sort of herd immunity.
So Jonathan, how have you restructured your portfolios, or how has your advice changed in the light of COVID?
Yeah, I mean, we've just sort of stuck to the principles of just having, you know, diversified portfolios, you know, across the board, making sure that we're not trying to make calls in terms of one direction or the other, because it is just so difficult to try and make these calls with a long-term sort of outlook. So I think it's important that you just stick to principles and just have diversified portfolios, you know, having healthy offshore exposure, and you know, making sure that if you're investing in the local environment that you're using the right sort of vehicles, But yeah, it's too difficult to call which way we think the markets are going to go in terms of how COVID's looking. I think with the vaccines on being rolled out, I think that's going to be extremely positive. But we need to get to that critical herd immunity level, and when that's going to be, whether it's going to be this year or in the next 2 to 3 years, nobody sort of knows. So yeah, I think once we reach that, we'll have a lot more clarity in terms of where the environment's going.
So I don't know if Sanlam Glacier has been on an aggressive selling strategy, but we have quite a few questions wanting to know, what do you think of Sanlam's Glacier? Dawn, do you use Glacier at all? Are these the tied agents?
No, they're not tied agents. You know, they're the list portion of Sanlam. They were very early in the PSP bespoke space, along with Momentum, which was quite progressive. Now we're talking about 13 or 14 years ago. And, you know, some of the sort of purchases and that Sanlam made, I'm actually, you know, in the life space, I'm actually quite happy with. And all I can say is that if you've got a list platform, Sanlam Glacier, Momentum Wealth is another one, Stanlib is another one. These list platforms where you're more inclined to find independent financial advisors and not tied agents, you know, you're going to be able to, on any of those decent list platforms, put together a portfolio on any of them, right? That is as good as each other. You know, it's become, you know, you'll find Alan Gray. You can put Alan Gray on Sanlam Glacier. You can put Coronation on Sanlam Glacier, and all of them, you know, have access to all these different funds. So, you know, I don't, you know, I'm more inclined to use Investec for a number of reasons, and the most compelling reason from my perspective is the IT interface. I like being able to do things myself. I like being able to draw up what ifs. I like being able to do my own quotes and all of those kind of things. And Investec, and I also don't want to necessarily every time one of the others brings out a new, oh, come and spend another 6 hours learning how to use our system. So, you know, from an advisor's perspective, you know, when all the lisps are much of a muchness, you know, maybe some of their platform fees might change from time to time, that I can give my clients better service when I really understand the interface and I can make quick changes to a client's portfolio. So I don't think there's anything wrong with Sanlam Glacier. It's just not my platform of preference right now.
Jonathan, what's your view on Glacier?
Yeah, so we use, as Dawn mentioned, we use multiple platforms for our clients. So, and Glacier is one of them that we make use of. And yeah, very happy with it. It's a good platform. Got great fund availability. So as Dawn mentioned, you can get access to any of the top asset managers on that platform. Their IT, we find their IT interface, you know, easy to use. Their reporting's great. So yeah, we make use of them along with 91 and Investec and Alan Gray. We think that Glacier platform's right up there with them. It's well costed, and it's a very user-friendly platform to make use of. Yeah.
Thank you. Now back to global markets. We've had a lot of questions in this week as well about the ARC fund headed by Cathy Wood, obviously with these great returns. And so what is your view on investing in global tech in general? Dawn, do you think it's very hot and frothy now? Do you think people should be pulling back? We also had a warning this week from Jeremy Grantham that this could be the worst bubble in living memory, and people could get really sort of scarred financially. So what is your view now? Do you think it's time to sort of take some money off the table, reschedule around that area, or reallocate?
You know, I think so. You know, I think the time has come to kind of, you know, take some profits. You know, I'm not saying get out of them completely. But, you know, when you've got an offshore portfolio, you know, you want it to be on the growth curve. Unless you're looking for, you know, a cash cow that produces lots of dividends, then you're buying a completely different set. But those are usually more mature companies. And in South Africa, you're looking at the sort of, you know, the Billitons, the Anglos and this kind of thing with their high dividend cash cow. But they're not sort of aggressively growing up that that growth curve. So all the techs have gone, you know, screaming up that tech curve. And you just have to sort of, and I mean, that was a very clear reason for it. I mean, it was COVID, everyone staying at home and doing that kind of thing. And, you know, for everyone that's gone up, you know, obviously huge damage to, you know, bricks and mortar retail and that kind of thing, you know, when one loses, another one gains kind of thing. But, you know, I do think that it's probably been blown out of the water a little bit. You know, obviously part of the appeal of Tesla has been, you know, their self-driving cars and the tech aspect and everything like that. So I do think that, you know, maybe for the moment, you know, tech has kind of like, you know, probably going to start leveling out. But, you know, if you plot Wall Street against the NASDAQ, you know, all this massive growth over the over last year came from the NASDAQ. It came basically from six shares, right? So that is massive share concentration. So I would say it's time to diversify. Look, we've been quite interested in the Russell 2000. You know, those are the smaller tech, you know, the in America, so smaller cap shares and that kind of thing, which have been doing somewhat better than these big tech and that kind of thing. But, you know, this whole Robin Hood thing has given me pause. I actually have spent the better part of the last day actually trying to wrap my head around the long-term implications because that worries me.
Mm. Jonathan, what do you have to add to that? I remember one of your colleagues, Debbie, was with us towards the end of last year and mentioned exactly what Dawn said, that it's actually not the S&P 500. It's just a handful of stocks that is powering up returns. So how are you factoring this into your asset allocation?
Yeah, so we're finding, as we mentioned with the local asset managers, that it's been a very sort of a tightrope that the asset managers had to walk in, that they've had to have NASPERS and have they've got the miners and the platinum stocks and try and avoid the Sassels and the Steinhoffs. Similarly, on the international front, it's also been very narrow in the sense that if you've had exposure to Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, Google, your portfolios have done really well. So it's been, you know, there's been five or six, maybe call it 10 stocks, including Tesla and the likes of them that have generated the phenomenal returns in that space. So it does get a little bit worrying when those stocks are controlling a massive part of the market. So I think that it is something to be mindful of, and it is something that we're looking at. So, you know, when we look at the international space, we're always quite happy to have, you know, sort of a blend of index trackers and, as well as active management. The index trackers are always useful to give you exposure to those big tech stocks because they're just such big players, part of the industry, whereas the active managers can then start to look for some active sort of alpha within the portfolios, try and add value to the portfolios by looking at perhaps looking at some of the value stocks. So it's kind of a debate about value versus growth. And over the last sort of 5 years, the growth stocks have just done super well. But now it might be a time for the value stocks to start coming up.
I'm not sure if I've lost you or you've lost me. The line was bad there.
Am I back? Yeah, I'm not sure what you guys got. I was just saying that, yeah, the difficulty is the debate around the value versus the growth stocks. I mean, I think it's important to have exposure to both sort of sides of it. You know, using the passive sort of index trackers to make use of to get access to the growth stocks, but then also having a blend of active management, which are looking for the value stocks to try and unlock some of that value, which could be there if there is any sort of concern with those growth stocks.
And hopefully they'll do a better job than the South African ones that you showed us earlier.
Let's hope, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so we've got time for two more questions, and there's a question here from Avril about an anticipated wealth tax coming. How will it be implemented? So obviously that's a bit of guesswork at the moment, but Dawn, do you get a sense that we will have a wealth tax, and if so, how do you think it will impact on people?
You know, wealth taxes are all over the world, haven't worked. You know, I think the one place that still has it in place is France. I think Holland, Netherlands also also has it in place. It's very expensive to actually administer and actually extract that money from people. Because I mean, this whole notion of wealth tax isn't new. I mean, it's been coming up for the last 15 years at least. Every time they have a look at it, they say, look, it's just going to be far too expensive to administer, because wealth tax then starts to tap into business owners and entrepreneurs and those kind of things, whereas just sticking the tax rate up to say 50% and it comes off PAYE and much much easier to administer. I think there's probably a fairly good correlation between the two, but the one thing that the government needs to avoid is killing the goose that lays the golden egg, because when you saw sort of massive increases in wealth taxes and things come into the UK, all that happened was those entrepreneurs just left, right, went and lived on the Isle of Man or Guernsey or Jersey or whatever it is, and so the really wealthy just say to hell with this and leave. So I just think that there's smarter ways of getting more money. I mean, for a start, for heaven's sake, you're losing 1.5 billion rand a year by no alcohol. Look, that's more probably they'd get in 1 month than they'd get in a year from wealth tax.
And Jonathan, is there a way you can avoid a wealth tax? We used to hear a lot about tax exiles and people sort of living in different jurisdictions to sort of get around the various taxes. Is that still an option for wealthier people?
Yeah, so I think it does. I mean, there are jurisdictions where one could work and live and earn an income in different jurisdictions. So that is an option. But there's a whole lot of consequences that come with that as a South African. So if you do decide to give up your South African sort of residency or tax resident status, there's a sort of a knock-on impact of that, which you need to be mindful of. So it is an option, but it could potentially be quite an expensive option if you wanted to uproot your sort of business and your life to a tax-free jurisdiction. Setting something up in one of those jurisdictions, that is definitely an option that could be done. And just to add to sort of what Dawn was saying is that I think the South African Revenue Service have some streams of tax options and revenue that they can still look to sort of, tax the base. I don't think that's necessarily going to be in the form of a wealth tax. We already have capital gains tax and estate duty tax. So those are two levers that they might look to pull on those rather before implementing a wealth tax. So we've seen capital gains tax going up over the last couple of years. So that could be something that they could look to increase, which would be a lot easier and probably a lot more efficient for them to generate some additional tax as opposed to implementing a new wealth tax structure. That would just be my sort of thoughts on that.
Okay, well, thank you very much for joining us this week, Jonathan. Jonathan is from Netto Invest in Cape Town. And thank you very much to Dawn Riddler as well of Coringa Wealth Ecology, which is based in Johannesburg. And thank you to everybody for joining us at the webinar. And do please send your questions through and suggestions for future topics. There's my email address. So thank you very much and have a good weekend.
Thanks, Jackie. Thanks,
Dawn. Bye, everyone.
Bye, Ron.
Bye, Jonathan.
Bye. Bye.